Hello, my friends, and welcome back to the What If Project podcast. My name is Glenn. I am your host, and you have arrived officially at episode 294. We are inching our way to episode 300, 6 episodes away. I cannot believe it. I have a lot of thoughts, but I will spare you. You can listen to them another day if you wish, or on that day you can fast forward through my thoughts, whatever. Episode 294, we're talking to Brandon Andrus today. He was on the show, I want to say like a year and a half ago. He wrote a book called What Can't Be Hidden. It's a novel, a fiction book. And the book ends on a literal cliffhanger. It's a fantastic book. Like, it speaks to so many issues of the day. But it ends on this cliffhanger. Like, that was the end of the story. And he didn't really have much intention of writing, like continuing it. But people are like, well, what happened to this person? Right? Like, what's going on in this story? Like, when is the next one coming out? So he decided to write the sequel, the next part of the story, which is called And So by Fire, which came out last August, I believe. And this book addresses a whole nother set of real life question. So in this episode, we talk about the story like a little bit, but what I was really interested in talking to him about is he's so good at talking about like the art and the craft of writing and how art and writing in particular, but all forms of art can be used in prophetic ways. Prophetic, that not meaning like, you know, foretell the future, but prophetic in the sense of being able to speak truth into the things of our day. Being able to look at a situation, look at something going on in the world, in our lives, or society, whatever, and speak wisdom, truth into that thing. And he does it so well in this book. And I ask him like so many questions about just like the process of putting something like masterpieces like this together. Like, did you have ideas, you know, charted out like on a big mind map on the wall with all the different characters, all the different things you wanted to address? We talk about that. We talk about some of the issues that these stories do address. Really good stuff. Brandon's one of those people I could like literally talk to all day. But you've got to go, if you haven't read the books, you could pick up And So by Fire and you could read it and figure out what's going on. But do yourself a favor, if you haven't already read the first one, What Can't Be Hidden, go back and get that book. Because I'm not like a big fiction reader, but I couldn't put that book down. I was like, every chapter, I was like, I got to keep reading because I need to know what happens to these people and what in the world is going on this in this place. We know where the story takes place. So really good stuff. I highly recommend his writing. I'll put all the links in the show notes. Also in the show notes, links to my books, Rethinking Everything, Emerging from the Rubble, and also the brand new What If Project Art Studio. I'm creating art these days. I have all these ideas. The whole story about the thing is on there if you want to know like what in the world it's about. But there's canvases up there. There's pictures from my sketchbook, my idea book, and the whole idea is just to let you into something that brings me joy and hope that it sparks joy in you as well to go find your own joy and do your own thing that brings you joy. And if you see a canvas on there that you want, you can have it. Name your price. As long as it covers shipping, even if I don't make a penny off of it, I don't care. I'll send it to you anyway because I only have room in my house for so many canvases. There's a few that I want to keep, but there's a bunch that that are up there that you are welcome to. And also, I'm doing commissions these days as well. People have reached out and said, oh, I really like this. Could you do this? I'm like, sure. And so same idea. It's a name your price thing. As long as it covers shipping, I don't care. I'm not interested in making money off of it. I just want to put a smile on people's faces. So anyway, whatifproject.net/art, also in the show notes, and also link to Patreon if you want to support the show, the podcast, the project financially. That is a place where you can do just that. So all that to say, my friends, episode 294 with Brandon Andrus. Enjoy. everybody, welcome back to the podcast. Today we're sitting down with a returning guest, the one and the only Brandon Andrus, who wrote a brand new book. Well, it's not new now. It wasn't new when we had first scheduled the episode, but it's called And So by Fire. It's a follow-up to his other amazing book. What was the name of the other book?
Yeah, What Can't Be Hidden.
What Can't Be Hidden, that's right. Which he was on to talk to us about the first time he was on the show. So anyway, Brandon, welcome back to the show. So good to have you back.
Hey. Good to be here, for sure.
Yeah, we've been trying to make this work. We've been talking before we hit record. It's been like, how long has this book been out?
That's a great question. Maybe August or September.
Yeah. So we've been trying to get this scheduled between my father passing away and my daughter being sick, and you have all your things going on, but we finally made it work. So thank you.
Plus the fact that Choir has like a million books come out a month. So
yes. And I do their social media. So I can contest to the fact that there's a million books coming out every single month.
Right.
I have this schedule. They're always like, all right, we have another one coming out next week, week after that, week after that. I'm like, oh man. Okay.
Well, you know, the insanity of it is when What Can't Be Hidden came out in September of 21, I think. Yep. I finished writing it in May of 2020, but every single creative did something during COVID. And that's right. I was in this massive line. So it took quite a while for it to come out, but it gave me more time to think about the sequel, certainly.
Yeah, for sure. So both of these books address some pretty big topics, some pretty lofty topics that are very prevalent for, I think, our personal lives and obviously our world, our society, things like that. So without giving away like spoilers for the book, because like we said, it is a fiction book, which we don't want to give away all the spoilers, but where does this story pick up? What kind of things are you addressing in this book compared to what you're addressing to the last book? Just elevator pitch it for us.
Yeah. So this comes on the heels of What Can't Be Hidden, and it picks up immediately after the previous one starts. And I was thinking, you know, can a person pick up And So by Fire without reading the previous book? And I think that it is possible, but obviously you're going to miss a lot of context where I try to fill in the blanks a little bit. So it is possible, but it's certainly going to make a more robust story if you've read the predecessor.
Yeah.
But from a big picture perspective, What Can't Be Hidden hit big topics like, you know, fundamentalism, nationalism, we, they versus, you know, we, they mindset. It asks questions about what is freedom and peace fundamentally. It challenged a lot of our thinking about what those things really truly are. And what I wanted to do with the sequel from a big picture perspective is I wanted that proverbial pendulum to swing the other direction. And it was really set up to be a critique of the other side of extreme progressivism, like not even reasonable progressivism, but the extremes. And so in one sense, What Can't Be Hidden hit one side, this one hit the far other side. And, you know, but then dialing it in a little bit more, this newest book, the sequel, has taken a look at things like artificial intelligence and misinformation, disinformation, and the way that we form perceptions based upon the news and what we, how we trust the media and how that form. So the previous book challenged that idea as well, but I wanted to introduce it in a different context for different people. And so, you know, I think everybody's going to be equally offended on every side of both of my novels, but I think they're very thoughtful and they're not aggressive at all. And, you know, this probably will come up later in our conversation, but fiction as fiction can be a very subversive tool to address things that people would normally, as soon as you bring it up in, say, a nonfiction manner, they would easily dismiss it and say, I disagree with you, I'm not going to hear it. And whenever you clothe ideas and perspectives within flesh and blood and give it emotion and give people a chance to see what the inner workings of what came to that decision and what happened when that, you know, what led to this, I think it gives people an opportunity to consider things that they normally would push off if they just read it you know, or it had a certain name on the book. Like, I'm not going to read those ideas. And so you can introduce so many subversive ideas below the radar that can, I think it's good because it allows us to be challenged without having our fists up ready to be in a defensive posture.
Yeah. So talk to me about the process of putting this book together. Because I know you're somebody who likes to talk about the kind of the craft of writing. And so I'm interesting to know about what was it like to put this, both of these books together, really, but in particular the second book, like, was the storyline always there? Did it involve a lot of brainstorming? Like, what did it look like to go from story in your head to paper? Because I've talked to other fiction writers and they say, I've heard different things. Like, some people are very meticulous. Everything is mapped out beforehand. They have the poster board on the wall and they're mapping the whole story out, all the character development. And then I had other people, I had somebody on the show a few weeks ago, and they said that they literally sat down to write the story without really much idea of how the characters were going to develop. And they were almost surprised by the turn that the story was taking. Like, they were just as involved in the story almost as the reader is, not knowing what's coming next. Like, what does it look like for you to put together these two books?
Well, I will say about the person that you just mentioned, the interesting thing that I found out from the development of two fiction books is that you can't dishonor the autonomy of your characters. And that seems insane to say, because you are literally the author who can dictate the terms of the story, the terms of the conversation and the narrative. And so whenever I discovered in the first book that there were times that I wanted characters to do certain things and go a certain direction, and they told me they could not.
Interesting. Yeah.
And I was like, man,
I love that.
This, And so I had to honor who they were and the trajectory that they, the path that they wanted to take. But yeah, to answer your question around development, the second book was really different than the first. And with the first one, I had a mountain of notes. I had everything charted out. It was kind of coming to me. And I knew, with the first book, I knew the ending almost at the beginning. And so I was moving towards something. And with the second book being a sequel, and understanding that the first book operated at three different levels, it operated at the basic story level that you're reading. And then there was the allegory beneath the surface. And then even below that, there's kind of this autobiographical element that I wanted to honor, even though you wouldn't be able to pick that out. So I wanted to have that same consistency with the sequel. I wanted to have the story, the allegory that's telling us as a society or a people something. And then I wanted it to honor me as a person autobiographically of what I'm working through. So with that being said, the what can't be hidden ended abruptly with this massive cliffhanger, literally. And and you know, for me to try to figure out really how to knit this thing together in such a way where there's a cohesive story with it really truly was something, because you're thinking, at least in my case, I was thinking at three different levels of like, what are the issues that I need to work through personally that I want to work through? And then what is it that I want to say to people in the second book that's different from the first book? And then thirdly, how can you write a compelling story that meets people with contemporary issues that maybe they're thinking through and dealing with, and some of the things that are happening technologically? And so, you know, and I will say that while these books, I've had difficulty categorizing them, but I think I finally landed on a place. We've kind of swung from fantasy to science fiction. And finally, I just realized that this is speculative fiction. There are elements of drama and fantasy, and there are elements of science fiction, certainly. However, speculative fiction is where I'm landing on this thing. But the process for the second one didn't involve as many notes. Certainly, I had some things that I was working through and things that I wanted to read and research just to understand. But a little bit different of a process through the second book.
Yeah. Now, was it, because I remember it, correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe I remember people were like asking for the second book, and I didn't feel like you were necessarily sold on writing the second book, because I remember people were saying, what happens, know, there is this cliffhanger, like literal cliffhanger at the end. Like, what is the story about? What is going on? Like, people are like pushing for you to answer the question. So, did you like, again, like I know you said you had the first, you had the ending in mind with the first book. Did you know, like, in your mind, did you have an answer to people's question, like, oh yes, this is what happened? And or did you
No,
feel
no,
like you had
no.
to flesh it all out in the story?
Glenn, it was legitimately the previous book ending on a cliffhanger was the end of the
So that
sentence.
was the end.
That
Done.
was it. Like it was a complete thought. And I basically autobiographically, I had taken and I've told people this before. Like I'm working through, some people go to therapy, I write a fiction book, you know, because there are things that
Right.
I wanted to work through.
Sure.
And so I had spent all this time writing What Can't Be Hidden and expressing all of these thoughts and ideas that I've had with me for, I don't know how old I was at the time, 46, 47 when I was writing it. And it took me all the way up to the present. I had completed the thought. And in some way, I had to be prescient and a bit forward thinking in the second book of like, who am I now? And what, how do I see myself now? And what things am I dealing with internally, and how do I resolve some things? So I, it was almost looking forward for me, but I did not have an answer to anybody's question because there was not going to be a sequel,
Right.
and I didn't force it either. You
Yeah.
know, it's one of those things where I thought, yeah, I mean, I suppose that if there's something to say, then I will do it. And as I thought about it, I'm like, well, I haven't. While I thought that I had completed the full thought, I realized I absolutely had not. There
Yeah.
was more to say allegorically that I wanted to say.
Yeah. Now, what about
I will
the,
tell you, can I tell you this?
yeah, please.
Glenn, I didn't write these books for the sake of telling the story. I wrote them 99.9% as a vehicle to say something.
Yeah.
And, you know, some people can sit down and just write a book, a story for the sake of telling a story. And I kind of walk away from that like, well, what are you trying to say? And if
Yeah.
people say nothing, then I'm,
Yeah.
hey, that's fine. That's a leisurely activity, but I do have many things I want to say through these two
Yeah.
books.
Yeah. I think that's a really great thing because I had Rob Bell on the podcast a few weeks ago, and he was talking about his new book, Where'd You Park Your Spaceship, which is a science fiction-ish kind of book. And I said to him, one of the things I said is somebody had asked me, like, what is this book about? And I said, there's about a lot of things, but one thing you can tell is that Rob Bell's like in his wheelhouse with this book, like having an absolute blast writing this. But that's the sense I get from your books, is that like these stories come from a very personal place. Because like I've read fiction books, I've never been a big fan of fiction because a lot of the ones I've read are just, it's just a story. That's great. But this book, these books, I can tell like these, Brandon is very invested in these stories because they're coming from a very deep, very real place. And so it's almost like you're not writing the book for me. You're writing the book for you, and it's giving you this great sense of joy to really process through all this different stuff. And you're almost just like inviting the reader in to kind of join you in the process, which is where I think the magic happens.
It does. You're exactly right. And honestly, I've had people read it and only read it as the story. And to that extent, I hope that I've written a really compelling story.
Sure.
There have been other people who I've surprisingly met with or talked to who've shown me the notebooks of notes that they've taken from reading these books, and
Right.
it surprised me, disarmed me. I really did not expect it, but it, I guess it's like anything. You can probably go as deep as you want to. And
Yeah.
I don't think that these books are a mile wide and an inch deep. I think that they are deep, depending on how much you want to invest.
Yeah, definitely. So when it comes to like the topics you address in the story, that's another thing I'm interested in, is like you talk about, like in the first book was really big on fundamentalism. Second book, you know, you touch on like artificial intelligence, things like that. Like I've written a couple of books and they're nonfiction books. And like in my mind, I'm like, okay, I know like chapter one's gonna address like hell, or you know, chapter two's gonna address like the cross, whatever. Like I have like laid out in my mind the topics I want to address. Did you and both of these books have the topics? Because you said they come from a personal place. things that you're wrestling with. So did you have like an idea of like, I want to address this, this, and this in this book, and then you kind of form the story around it? Or did the topics also kind of evolve as you were writing the book?
I think it's both. I think it's both because there's certainly a larger sense, like a bigger 30,000 foot view where there's certain things that I want to tackle. You know, I think both books are rooted in, I mean, if somebody said distill these books down into one sentence of what you're trying to say, I mean, there's probably a lot of sentences and I could probably write a few paragraphs on what I'm trying to get at. But essentially, I would say it's relationships and how we are toward each other. And I think that by saying that, it means that maybe the only way that we have relationships that look whole and healed in a sense is when we take the personal journey of doing that inner work ourselves, right? Because we can only be as healthy in our relationships as we are as individuals. So I would say ultimately it's about us as people and how we relate to each other, and then also how communities relate to each other. But it's really invested in our own individual journey and inner work.
Yeah.
I would say in many ways, you know, if people if people said, give us an idea, if there's a person that we could point to who does nonfiction work that it most closely resembles, I would say these are fiction books that resemble Richard Rohr. It's a lot of the same things that he is tackling in all of his books, of just the inner process and the manifestation of that, you know, that looks kind of like shalom. It looks like this work towards restoration, not just within yourself, but in your relationships and communities in the world.
Yeah, that's really good. I've noticed that I think on the Amazon page, I could be wrong, I think it says that this book is like a meta narrative, meta fiction. What is that? What does that phrase mean? Because I'm new to that phrase. I've heard it a couple times in relation to a couple other books. I think one other one by Quire is out with that same kind of tag. But what does that mean? And how do these stories, because I know you said you've bounced back and forth on like what category this fits in, but what is that category about, and in what ways does these stories kind of fit into that?
And maybe I don't even completely understand it. I mean, I think that I do, but the way that I would understand it is just knowing that there are arcs that are occurring in the story from a narrative perspective that are larger. Like I mentioned earlier, it's like the 30,000 foot view rather than dialed into the 30 foot view. And it's something that is shaping the story and the trajectory of where it's going and where it's going to end. And so for the first book, I would say one of the meta narratives is peace. Another one is freedom and our understanding of it. Maybe another meta narrative would be understanding either one of those in the context of escaping fundamentalism. You know, so you've got these big ideas that are controlling the story and what that process looks like for a character or characters who are moving from one ideological idea to the next, and what that process looks like. For the second book, I would say the meta narrative has a lot to do with misinformation and disinformation and how that clouds our perspective. It limits our view. It causes us to arrive at certain conclusions about people or people groups. And, you know, and that's the other thing I think in both books is, and I know this definitively, there are parts in each book where people have arrived at certain conclusions based upon stereotype or based upon how it's been portrayed either by the community or say media. And there's work that's going on of uncovering a person at a deeper level where it challenges their assumptions that they've had. And to me, I'm like, that is one of the meta narratives that has to be consistent in both books, because it's the issue that we deal with as people, in my opinion, predominantly in our culture.
It seems like, I mean, I would think that like then most fiction I think would fall into that category, I would think, because I mean I can think of all the fiction books I've read, which is not like a lot, but like I can think of there is that story, there is that storyline where the character is moving from one narrative to the next, usually, and that's usually what kind of hooks you into the story, is that this person is evolving, this person is changing, this person's kind of coming to grips with something in their life or in their society. So I would think a lot of, I guess a lot of fiction could use that tagline, even though I've
Yeah,
never heard it before.
I think you're exactly right. To be more specific in these books, I would say from I try to dial it down to be a lot more specific to the contemporary issues that we're dealing with. And so, let's just say Anso by Fire, we have this kind of priest character, and there are these ideas about what this priest character represents, of how the community sees him, about how the media portrays him, or even the disinformation that's been put out about him to continue to shape narrative. And what we end up finding through all of this misinformation, is when two characters, him and another character, come together, a lot of those presuppositions are challenged, where she sees through this cloud of misdisinformation and sees humanity. So I think you're right. In every story, there are awakenings that are happening of characters. I think in these books, I'm trying to be a lot more specific into the specific contemporary caricatures, maybe, if that's a good word, contemporary caricatures that we've created, and trying to get below that. I guess the other thing is just trying to get people to not so easily dismiss these caricatures, but understand the humanity that is behind it.
That's right. Yeah, I mean the disinformation piece is huge, because I was thinking as I was reading through the book, I mean just thinking about, I was talking to my wife about it a couple of weeks ago, you know, with the election coming up, you know, and it's like I said to her, I said what bothers me so much about politics, and it's always been this way and probably always be this way, is that I feel like neither side is telling the whole story of the other
That's
side, right? I mean, and that's what frustrates
100%.
me so much, is because it's just like you have the one side that's telling you everything that's wrong with the other side and everything that's right with us, and the other side doing the
That's
same
right.
thing. And I say it's just so hard to see through all of that. And no matter what website, no matter what news place you go to, like they're all putting their own spin on it. I feel like there's so many different balls in the air. Like you don't know what to believe. You don't, everybody's demonizing the other person. I said, it's just so frustrating. I said, but behind all of that stuff, there is a living, breathing person who puts their pants on the same way that you and I do. They have a heart beating just like we do. Like they're breathing the same air we're breathing. I said, but we lose all of that humanity in the midst of all this misinformation. And I said, the closer we get to election season, like the hotter the flame gets, and the more they turn up the heat, you know. And I said, it's just so frustrating. A part of me just wants to like completely check out from all of it.
Yeah, I mean that's the part of it. I would say that, because I get a lot of maybe criticism from both extremes. And one thing I would say is I don't necessarily think that we have to check out of the process. I think that there's, still, if there are certain things that we are working toward that honors people, that works for the integrity of people and the restoration of people, I think we have to do our due diligence in every way that we can to pursue those avenues. So I don't think checking out from the system is something that I would, or that I'm even trying to say in the books at all. But
And
I
I'm not saying
think,
that's the right thing to do. I'm just saying that
no, of
sometimes I
course
feel
not.
that way inside. I'm like, oh
That's
God, I just
right.
want to
That's
turn it
right.
all off.
That's exactly, well, but that's the impulse of all of us, right? But I will say that there's an element which you address where, it is, I mean, I can't tell you how many times that I've either been a part of something or watched something where two people who are diametrically opposed ideologically. I always bring up the same example, but I don't think I've ever brought it up here, but it's one of my quintessential examples of how important this work is at a human level. Remember Morgan Spurlock, who did the Super Size Me documentary? He ate McDonald's for 30 days. So he did a television show based on the 30 days, and he took people who were on completely different ends of the ideological spectrum and put them together for 30 days, living with each other, in the context of one of the people's homes. And in this one episode, he had somebody who I think was at the time like a Minuteman who would walk. I mean, this is perfect for today. He was very prescient in what he was doing, but he had a Minuteman who was watching the border and who spends all of his volunteer time chasing down people, arresting people, whatever. On the flip side, there was a family of illegals who were in our country living, and Spurlock took the man and had him live with that family for 30 days. And as you can expect, at the beginning, there was heated arguments, there was visceral emotion, there was a lot of tears and arguing and screaming and yelling. But guess what? As they continue to live together, and as you see beneath the skin of a person, and you start understanding their emotions and their lived experience, and you're sharing meals together, there's something that changes where you don't see a person for the label that they wear or the cause or the stereotype. And by the end of it, not to say that I'm not making any political statement here, I'm just saying things, the scales proverbial fall from the eyes. Hearts really do change whenever you discover the humanity of a person. And by the end of it, there were tears, but they weren't tears of hating each other or arguing about positions. It was that they finally broke through that to see each other. And to me, that's what these books are about. Is me trying to take that extra step of helping people walk to that place of meeting people where we see beneath the veneer and see them humanly. Is that a word? Humanly.
I like it. It is now. But you talked earlier about how, like, this is a good segue into that, back into that, how fiction can be really prophetic in a way, and that it can speak into the situations of our day, but kind of from the back door, so to speak. And you said before, like, how your writing, the things you're addressing, is very Richard Rohrish in the sense of, you know, the teachings, so to speak, that are coming through the story. Like, in what ways do you think, maybe you could talk a little bit more about how, like, fiction has that power to be a prophetic voice, maybe even more so than just someone who's coming right out and just saying what they want to say. Like, a Richard Rohr is going to write a book, it's going to sell millions of copies because he's stating these really amazing things, you know. And that's why, even like Rob Bell's previous books, like, you know, he writes a book and he states these things, but then you write this fiction book that you could probably, you, like, your books, you could write other book, you could write nonfiction books addressing all these different things, and it'll probably sell a lot of
Sure,
copies.
sure.
But in what ways does this, does the power of fiction kind of have a, maybe even a bigger prophetic voice in kind of bringing these truths to the surface? Maybe that goes for all of art,
Yeah.
not even just writing, but maybe
No,
even all of
that's
art.
spot on. I'll say it this way, the modern caricature of a prophet is, and I've been on the street corners, and I've been through college campuses, and I've seen the megaphones, and I've seen the placards and the billboards. And I think that most people, especially nowadays, associate anything prophetic to having to be loud and boisterous. It has to be in your face and damning and judgmental. I think that that's probably not, I mean, if we're going to recover a word, maybe this is a word worth recovering, is prophetic certainly isn't it. I mean, I suppose that in some sense it could be that. It could be walking through the streets naked to get people's attention, if you have a message. And I think that's been done before. But I think in another sense, it's not a prognostication of the future and trying to foretell events, but how can art be used in a way that challenges assumptions, that challenges the inertia of where we're going? And honestly, and So by Fire, the latest book, I bring up this one idea with different characters several times about inertia. It's like with inertia, you have something that feels like that has a movement to it that we cannot control. And many times it feels like we're being taken to a place where, whether we agree with it or not, it feels like it's moving in a direction, right? So I think prophetically, what that means is that whenever people can use artistic means or creative means to slow down the inertia or even break the momentum of the inertia, to me, that is life-giving work. That's meaningful work. So I think in some sense with my books, that's what I'm trying to do. I feel the tug and the violent pull of in different directions, the inertia of that, the extreme groups. And I feel like that sometimes, at least this is the way that it feels, that we have to choose. It's like, there's movement this direction and this direction. So you have to choose which train you're going to get on. And I just think we need more voices that say it's a false dichotomy. It's not a real choice.
It's an
In
illusion.
fact, it's an illusion. And that's the point of art. I think art is disruptive, and it can certainly be disruptive in a negative sense where it's tearing down, and maybe at the right times, that's important. But at the same time, I really feel like that, especially with my books, they're disruptors, but it's disruptors of trajectory. It's disruptors of inertia, and it's challenging people to get off of the train.
Not pick a train, but get off the trains. But I think that's a huge thing, because I mean, I've been talking a lot about on the podcast with people about that idea of oneness, and that everything is interconnected. And I think that that's a beautiful truth that I think comes through in a lot of ways in your stories. But just that fact that like the dichotomy is an illusion, like the separateness is an illusion. Like if we could just get past this idea of black and white, right and wrong, good and bad. Like if we could just get past who's right, who's wrong, get past all of that stuff and be able to see, like you said earlier, the humanness behind all of that, and the fact that that's the very thing that connects us, whether we believe in some kind of divine force or we don't. Like at the end of the day, we're all breathing the same thing. We're all the same, made up of the same stuff, the same stardust. We're all made up of the same thing. Like if we could just grasp that one idea, there's so many different things I think that we could solve and get past if we could just get past that idea. We got to get on one train or the other and pick our direction.
Well said. With what can't be hidden at the beginning, it's the setting is on an island, and people who want to dig into the metaphor and symbolism of what can't be hidden, especially, we'll find that the island represents the wholeness that you're talking about. And there is the fract. I mean, in fact, I think I mentioned this on your previous podcast. The idea came to me while I was mowing one day in 2019, and I just saw this circle or an oval with a fracture in it. And I thought, it's an island, and the people are broken, and there are black and white, groups of people, not racially, but there's a black and white element to it
Either
if people
or,
are at each other. Yeah, right. And so certainly, yeah, that is tapping into exactly what you said.
So last question for you. What would you say, maybe this is true for you, maybe not, but did these characters, as you were developing them, teach you anything about yourself, because you said before about how giving the characters their autonomy, giving them their ability to kind of write their story. Like, as you are writing their story, can you look back and say any particular moment that, like, Thora or somebody else in the story taught
Yeah.
you something about you? Answered a
I will
question for you,
say,
maybe.
yeah, I will say that many of the characters were me already, in different ways.
The
Even
many
the anti
personalities of
yeah,
Brandon.
well, I was able to look at myself and say, in what ways do I share character attributes with the antagonist, not just the protagonists. And each character is nuanced, and so you again, we get into this false dichotomy of protagonists are always good, antagonists are always bad. And so with these stories, what we find out is, man, your protagonists have elements that are not very endearing, and there are some parts of them that are amazing. But then on the flip side, with the antagonist, here I am, creating a character that is dark or insidious and working against whatever, but I'm seeing elements of myself in that. But to answer your question, what did I learn? I think that there was a real sadness in the second book, And So by Fire, because as it's dealing with misinformation and disinformation, I grieved with one character, and probably the main, I don't even know, in second book, it's hard to tell who's a protagonist and an antagonist, and I made it purposefully gray. But one of the characters, I just lamented with this with him, because I thought, what chance does he have? He's one of the characters that's being carried by the inertia of the island, carried by the narratives that are being created, and trying to see through it, of figuring out for himself, like, is my own sister for me or against me? Is my, and it, I think that it taught me that I've got to be really careful. I have to be really careful about, especially now. And I think that if people, I mean, I think maybe this is way too bold, maybe making too big of an assumption, but I think that we can hopefully all agree that there is disinformation and misinformation across the ideological spectrum that goes on every day. And we cannot be so reactionary to, I mean, even if you swear up and down, I mean, left and right. I mean, part of the point that I'm making in So by Fire is that we live in a time where images can be manufactured, where video can be manipulated, where certain facts that didn't even happen can happen. And I thought that I was being way ahead in when I wrote this, but it's like the speed at which artificial intelligence and disinformation through video audio is coming at us is way faster than I anticipated. I thought I was writing it to be about 3 to 4 or 5 years ahead. In fact, I was probably about 12 months to 18 months ahead. So now it's super relevant right now, what I'm saying, but I was hoping that I had a little more time.
I mean, a big thing just happened with the Taylor Swift video that came out that was
Absolutely.
like an AI thing, and everybody thought it
Yep.
was real, and it got millions and millions of shares on X or Twitter or whatever. And then,
Yep.
now there's like a big lawsuit. But I think it's forcing people to really think about, like, what are the laws going to be about this kind of stuff? How are we going to deal with these kind of things once they start to surface? Because it's only a matter of time before it starts in schools and things like that. Kids can make videos to do whatever they want and have their
That's
friends
right.
doing whatever they want in the video, and it's not even true.
I think that I think that there are certain things that we are probably waiting for to happen at the macro level. I would say at an individual level, the thing that we can do is suspend judgment. Like, I'm going to tell you one that is just now we're getting somewhere. Jeez, this is going way too far. This is one that I cannot believe that I still don't even know where I land on it. This is the example of the problem that we have. So you've seen, maybe the audience has seen all of these videos of Britney Spears dancing crazily, right? With knives or whatever. And she looks sweaty and whatever. I mean, I could say other things, but it looks manic. And I saw a video that came out 2 months ago, and someone took one of those videos where she's dancing and the knife flashes above in front of her face, and for just one frame, and they paused it, it flashes another face like that. I mean, I don't even know what you call it. It's like an avatar that can go on top of it. And I was like, wait a second. Have any of these been real? Is that really her? Is there some? I mean, all I'm saying, I'm not making any declaration here, but I'm like, this is the fundamental problem that we have, and why we have to be so careful to suspend judgment on anyone, because you do not know what's real.
That's right.
You do not, there's no way that you know what's real. Like, where do you get your information? From your phone. Like, hardly anyone watches television anymore. I could make an argument about that too, but it's like the things that are being put in front of our face based on an algorithm, based upon I would say even algorithms that aren't even based on your personal preference, but on what people need to shape. There's the inertia. We've just got to be careful, Glenn. That's the thing, and that's where I go with ANSO by fire, is that you have an entire community where their perception is being shaped by what they're consuming,
It's really
and
good.
the casualty is us.
I think as the technology advances, we have to be all the more careful, not just about as the technology advances, but also the ways that we get our information advances. Because 15, 20 years ago, we weren't getting our information on these phones. But now all of a sudden, it all comes to there, and it's only a matter of time before 10, 15 years down the road, we have another device that's bringing in another stream of information in another way. And it's so important, like you said, to be conscious and aware of these different things and just keep that in mind, like we said earlier, about again the humanity behind it all, because we lose sight of that so easily as we pick our sides, pick our trains, and we go to what we think is our destination.
Strange times, man. Very strange times, but I think it strange times, but I can't think of a better time to be on the forefront of the things that we're talking
That's
about.
right. That's huge.
I think that there is a great deep desire for people to seek something deeper rather than the surface. To me, this is important work. At least I'm trying to do it in a way that's not standing on the street corner with the placards and the bullhorns.
That's
I'm
right.
saying here's a very thoughtful way for a person to rethink things and go deeper. So anyway.
Last thing I want to say is, really quick, you pointed out before about, the characters in your book, the antagonist, the protagonist, about aligning or finding yourself in all the people. And I think that's such a huge thing, especially like even when it comes to reading the Bible, because I had a seminary professor who made us find ourself as an assignment in the characters that we typically hate in the Bible. Whether it's the Pharisees or whatever it is, and try to find yourself in that, because I think there's a lot of power in that when you can align yourself with the negative person in the story, who you perceive to be the negative person. How do I fit into this category? What would I do if I were in this person's shoes? How would I react? I think that's a huge thing. So I think if people do pick up your books and they do read your stories, especially in the first book, you're going to pick your side right away. Who's good, who's bad, who's
That's
evil, who's
right.
not.
That's
But if you
right.
can take yourself and put yourself in that person that you think is the evil person, I think there's a lot of things that might come to light about yourself.
Oh, what an amazing template, though, with this is the exact thing that Jesus did, right? And it doesn't matter how people want to necessarily categorize Jesus or who they think he is. At a very basic, fundamental level, the genius was putting together parables where people could enter into them and see who they are in the story.
Yep.
You know, it's so much much more different than preaching at someone and saying, you know, you guys are bad and you guys are sinners and whatever. It's like the beauty of narrative, the beauty of creative work, of parables, of long form story, is that it really truly does give people the autonomy to kind of work through this journey to find their path, to evaluate themselves based upon the characters that they're interacting with. And to me, that's the brilliance of fiction work.
That's right. So good, Brandon. We're just about out of time, but this has been a blast, as I expected. So thanks for making time for me and for our listeners.
Yeah, I appreciate it. People can just go to my website, brandonandrus.com, and I think that it's going to have everything that they need to, whatever. I've lost my words.
It's all in there. I'll put the links in the show notes for people.
Thank you, Glenn.
Thanks, bud.